This is Rob Gray from ASU and PerceptionAction.com. Today on the Perception and Action podcast, my interview with Duarte Araújo, director of the Sports Expertise Lab at the University of Lisbon in Portugal. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Perception and Action podcast, where I discuss how psychological research can be applied to improving performance, accelerating skill acquisition, and designing technologies. In today's episode, my interview with Duarte Araújo from the University of Lisbon. Duarte received his PhD from the University of Lisbon, and as you will hear, also spent time at the Vrije University in Amsterdam. In 2001, he was awarded a Young Investigator Award from the European College of Sports Sciences. In my opinion, the work by Duarte and his colleagues is some of the most innovative in sports science. In our discussion, we touch on topics including an ecological approach to talent identification, affordances, nonlinear pedagogy, developing sports analytics with a sound theoretical basis, and his upcoming book, Performance Analysis in Team Sports. Hope you enjoy.
Not 10 years ago, I was a child. I was a good boy and you let me go. Now I'm on a talk show, talk show.
Hi, everyone. My guest today is Duarte Araújo from the University of Lisbon in Portugal. He's an associate professor and director of the Sports Expertise Lab. I think the last time we saw each other was in a conference in Ireland, right? And yes. I remember it well because I remember you were frantically, it was during the World Cup, right? 2014, yeah. You were frantically working, getting reports back to the Portugal national team, right? Between the matches.
It went well.
Yeah. So thanks for taking some time to talk with me today.
My pleasure, yeah.
Yeah. So to get off, you know, I kind of start this way with everyone is, how did you get interested in doing sports science?
Well, Rob, it's really a pleasure and a privilege to be here in this podcast with you. So thank you very much for inviting me. I remember well that meeting we had in Ireland, in the north of Ireland, and Portugal was not keeping the pace of the competition. So they were losing and they were eliminated during those times, so it was tough for me. Well, I was always a practitioner of sports. I did some middle distance running in track and field, some climbing and some judo at a competitive level, but not international level, but I was playing it seriously. And I always wanted to understand it a little better, but from the perspective of psychology, I always wanted to understand a little bit better about behavior. So that's why I started to do a degree in sports sciences. And well, I got the subject of sports psychology and I fell in love with that topic immediately. Mm-hmm. That's really what I was looking for. I was not very much convinced by them, or at least I didn't felt attracted with the use of verbalizations and verbal protocols to measure behavior. So I was always looking more into behavior and how it can be expressed. So that's why I went in much more into a more experimental psychology perspective and cognitive psychology perspective. That's the direction that I got in my first studies. Mm-hmm. I was working with a professor here in Portugal, and he was a cognitive psychologist working in sports. So in the very traditional way, reaction time and all that. And I was really enjoying to work with him. I was starting my master's degree with him. And then the curious thing was that I went to a congress in Israel. It was a international congress of sports psychology, where I presented my preliminary results. I was studying sailing on that time.
Okay.
And there was a person that I didn't know on that time there. It was Reino Bootsman. Was there. And after my talk, he came to me, offered me a beer, and starting to make me very challenging questions that I never thought about in my life.
Anyone who knows him will be not surprised by that.
And but that was really a key point for me. It was really a tipping point because I really start to make questions that were very much different from the ones I did before. It was more about why do you think information is not perfect? Why do you think about cues and not that the information can be reliable? Why do you think that you need the pictures in your head before you do the things? Mm-hmm. And it was questions that I never thought about it before. So it was really interesting for me that to address that, that was maybe when I really started to see myself as a researcher, because that was really challenging. I really thought, oh, I have to know more about this. Mm-hmm. So that was maybe the tipping point.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was the point that inspired you to look into ecological psychology?
Yeah. That was really the link. And on that time, I was doing my master degree was an European master's degree. So I had part of it in a broad university. And the abroad university I chose by chance, it was the Free University of Amsterdam.
Okay.
So it was Claire Michaels there. It was Peter Beck there. Everybody was there. So I after this discussion with Reino Butzma, I went to the Free University and I have all these people that very knowledgeable about ecological psychology there. So I had very fruitful discussions and that started to point me into that direction. That was how it all started with a more ecological approach. And dynamics came a little bit later on when I started to work with Keith Davids, mm-hmm. maybe two years after that in 98, 99, when we tried to incorporate, well, ecological psychology does not related with that, with the dynamical systems approach. These two perspectives can be quite different. For example, there are people in cognitive psychology following a dynamical approach, mm-hmm. and there are people in ecological psychology that don't touch on dynamics. So with Keith Davids, we start to combine these two perspectives. Keith was very keen on dynamics, and it was from this relationship that the ecological dynamics started to be a part of our way of thinking about the sports tasks and the sport performance and sport expertise.
Yeah, and do you think your initial start in traditional experimental psychology was a good help preparation for this, to get into sports science and these kind of things?
I think so. I think I liked the rigor and the careful we must have in doing in measuring things in having reliable numbers, not just numbers but reliable numbers that mean something. Although I didn't felt completely comfortable with the type of tasks we were doing with those simple button pressing and joystick movements, and that I didn't enjoy that much. So that's why also having a more ecological look into sports was really easy for me, because I really wanted to do other tasks, not just those so simple.
Yeah, no, I had a very similar path to myself. I'm obviously biased, but I really think it's a great path. Going through experimental psychology, you learn how to design experiments, how to quantify the stimulus that people are seeing, how to get out confounds. But yeah, I had the same frustration with the tasks, the lack of activity. So yeah, let's get into some of the stuff you've done. And one of the things I wanted to start off with is, you know, things you've done with Keith and your other colleagues talking about what talent is and how mm-hmm. you define talent and how you identify it. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, it's a huge question.
Yes.
I know how to have a precise answer to that.
No.
What I think we try, instead of looking into talent as something that is possessed or is inside of someone, we try to look into talent as something that is clearly dependent on the circumstances and on the environment where the person is behaving. So, and I think by having this link, we are not looking into the traits or the issues that can be possessed, but how these relationships make expert performance possible. And by doing this, we also understand why sometimes very high-level players play well and the other day they don't play so well. Mm-hmm. So this is something that is not possessed, that you can show whenever you want, but it's really dependent on circumstances. Mm-hmm. So this is the approach we are taking when we look into talent and expertise as something that is to be fully understood. We can have a good look at it if we see as a shared as resources that are shared between the individual and the environment. But by saying this, I'm not saying that it's not important how is the individual and how is the environment, but how both things relate. So to give you an example, it's not how what is your hate, but how you use your hate.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more this is the perspective that we want to address. So it's not just telling everybody to play basketball should have 2 meters, but it's more how do you use the hate you have and how can you achieve some tasks with the hate you have.
Yeah, no, exactly. I was talking with someone the other day about American football. In American football, they have this big thing called the combine, where they test all the college athletes to decide whether they're going to draft them into the professional leagues. And yeah, it's all, they essentially ignore all of the film of them actually playing, and they measure speed, height, and then they do have some psychology things, but they're all the way the other extreme. They're, mental, how dedicated are they? Are they, that perceptual motor stuff in the middle is completely missing. So,
And I fully agree. And I see that in many other sports that, and sometimes these measurements are in doing activities in a very different way than they do in competition. For example, the running, when they test running, it's in a very different task than the ones they do when they are competing.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of running, the posture they have when they run with the ball, it's very different from how they are measured for 400 meters, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this issue of how you are using your own resources according to the circumstances is really a key issue if we want to understand talent. And there's also a key issue for me is because normally talent is seen more during the youth and during the time that children are developing. So this means that some manifestations that may happen at one age can be completely different 2 years after that or 3 years after that.
Mm-hmm.
And if we are looking for some things that are processed by the children at that time, we are missing how all these constraints are interacting with each other a few years later. And they can be really outstanding, and we are missing them because they are not showing something that we believe is useful to be a talent. Yeah.
No, I think there's a lot of a lot of ways we can improve with that. Another thing, I think we'll get to this later is, when we talk about teams, but in the NFL, the football one I mentioned, one of the things they do in this combine is they make quarterbacks throw to other players they've never mm-hmm. played with before. They're missing all these things that shared experience of the environment. But what happens is the ones that are really good and expected to go in the draft high, they refuse to do this, and they have their own day where they throw to the guys they're used to playing with, so they look better, and so they understand the concept. So I think that's a really important area that we need to get onto, and
mm-hmm.
and one of the things you mentioned in this article about talent identification and throughout your work is the idea of affordance and the idea of the one that's not talked about. I know you mentioned the effectivity is kind of the other side. Can you talk a little bit how those go together?
Sure. Nice, very interesting questions you are making. Well, affordances are seen as the possibilities offered by the environment. And recently, we tried to add something to this. So we include the idea of affordances not simply as possibilities offered by the environment, but also as invitations that the environment can solicit to the actor.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is important because it means that all the affordances are not equal for the same person and for everybody. Some of them can be more attractive for you than in one moment than in the other moment. And this somehow helps in understanding why some courses of action are so intuitive, so immediate compared with the others. So you are not in a situation that you have to deliberately have to select between all the possibilities. You have solicitations that are evident for you from the environment. So this is one thing, how the environment is calling for you. The other is how can you, the environment can only call for something that you are able to do. And these capabilities that you have to act on something are called the effectivities.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, in a very extreme sense, there are some animals that can understand the ultrasounds, that can perceive the ultrasounds, but we can't. So it means that there are some solicitations in the environment, or some possibilities in the environment that are species specific, but we also can understand these among people. There are some solicitations and some invitations and some possibilities that are possible for some people, but not for the other because of their own capabilities. Mm-hmm. And so this is called these capabilities to act on the possibilities offered by the environment are called the affectivities. Mm-hmm. So it's not something that is strictly possessed, but is also in the relation with the possibilities offered by the environment. Effectivities in the affordances are a kind of both sides of the coin. So mm-hmm. you can only have that possibility if you have the capabilities for that.
Yeah, no, I really like that. I like that invitation idea I think you had to leave, but at the end of that conference I mentioned at the start, we had a little round table about whether affordances are a useful construct for, you know, sports science and other things. And one of the things I've always had an issue with is a lot of times when people define it, they're basically one and the same as information, right? When mm-hmm. when I talk about baseball, people talk about the affordance people are picking up is hit ability of the ball. That mm-hmm. to me, that was always just one and the same as talking about its time to collision or its direction, its trajectory, right? But if you add in capability, you add in this invitation, yeah. I think it adds a little more to it than just that. Yeah,
yeah, I fully agree. And I think Gibson was a very insightful person. Mm-hmm. But after that, lots of work was needed. And I think mm-hmm. several people worked on that in order to clarify a little bit what he was meaning by information, affordances and all that. And I think all these concepts should be seen together instead of just emphasizing affordances or information or capabilities. By seeing them together, it can be very useful to understand performance. But I also think that something is missing in all this picture, that the Gibsonians don't pay too much attention to that. Ecological psychologists don't pay too much attention. That is the role of agency, of the actor that is perceiving and acting. And this agency, I think, it goes beyond the simple use of effectivities, but also how can you delay your response to the invitation? How can you stop an invitation that you started to address? Mm-hmm. And how can you modulate or change it towards another path, if that is possible? So I think all this picture can be seen not only if the environment is attracting you to act, but also how can you resist and change and challenge these invitations and these possibilities offered by the environment. So I think this issue of agency also is very important for me, not as something that is independent of the environment, but as something that also modulates, delays and change your interaction with the environment.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really important point. And I think I mentioned this when I was talking with Keith. I think at times you can almost think of sometimes ecological psychology as behaviorism, right?
It's
stimulus.
Yeah.
I couple to it. I have no choice. So I'm dragged along in my actions. So obviously that doesn't fit with a lot of what we see.
Yeah, sure. And also that is a key difference. It's because organisms will act differently. So it's not the explanation of behavior is not simply based on the conditions of the environment, as behaviorists said, of the conditions of the enforcement, but also based on the effectiveness and capabilities of the individual in one sense. But on the other sense, I also think that this role of agency should be emphasized as something that modulates this relationship with or challenges or change or delays this relationship with the environment. Mm-hmm. And this is, I think this for me is a key difference with behaviorism. And another one is that behaviorists were not really interested in the structure of behavior. They were just interested in the result of the behavior. Mm-hmm. So, but for us, how you are interacting with the environment is also a key issue.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. You were not just interested in the action, the outcome, the performance, but also the coordination underneath.
Exactly.
Is just as important. Yeah, no, that's a really good point. So within this, turn to another thing I know you've worked on within the, you know, affordance idea, and you get into the constraints approach And one of the things I've liked about your work is you have dug into some concrete examples of that, particularly in I'll call it soccer, at the effect of small-sided games, changing the size of the field. And can you talk to a little bit about that kind of work?
Well, sometimes these labels get a little bit confused, so I try to clarify before I go to the example.
Okay, good.
Well, the broader theoretical approach, we call it ecological dynamics because it really goes into how the performer with his own characteristics interact in the world, and this interaction is continuous, is dynamic. So that's why ecological dynamics is the broad theoretical perspective. But then we think that this has very good applications into how the sports are taught. So we call this approach nonlinear pedagogy because it's we emphasize the nonlinear role of learning, the self-organization of learning and of behavior, not simply how learning is a summation of something, is a sum of something that you are acquiring time after time. It has a nonlinear flavor. That's why we call nonlinear pedagogy. Mm-hmm. And inside of this nonlinear pedagogy view of coaching and training, we have this constraints-led approach. It's one example. It's not the only one. It's the one we have emphasizing more, but there can be other approaches like Wolfgang Schulhorn differential learning approach, for example, mm-hmm. is also another example of nonlinear pedagogy.
Okay.
So this is just to clarify this all these concepts.
No, it's good.
And from the constraints-led approach, what we emphasize here is that if behavior is emergent, if learning is an emergent process, we can channel it. We cannot prescribe it linearly, but we can channel it, we can shape it towards some direction that can be functional for the competition. So that's why the idea of manipulating relevant constraints is based on the idea of channeling the learning experiences towards functional solutions that will work, we expect, or may work in the competition.
Okay.
An interesting issue here is that this way of manipulating constraints is always done with an intimate relationship with the coaches, with their experiential knowledge. And them are, for me, the best persons to tell you what are the relevant constraints. Mm-hmm. I cannot derive that from a theoretical point of view. This is relevant, this is not. But with the coaches, they immediately point towards the key issues that should be manipulated. So based on that, we can manipulate pace, time, whatever it is, the rules of the game, in order to make some situations that the coach think are important for this team to develop happens many more times than those that would happen in a normal game, for example. Mm-hmm. So if you want to have more 3-on-3, we manipulate the space and some of the rules in order to make these 3-on-3 be more often than if we let that the game offer that to the players. Mm-hmm. So this is the key idea behind the constraints-led approach.
Yeah. So and I know you tried to quantify some of these effects of doing these kind of things. Yeah.
Would you like me to go?
Sure. That'd be great. Yeah. Maybe one example. Yeah.
One key idea that we had when we were trying to understand team behavior is that we should have some team properties that are not captured in the individuals. Mm-hmm. So we were looking into how can we address these team properties. So we start to do more facial measures, for example, the area covered by the team, by the periphery. If we put a line behind it, we call it the surface area, the area covered by all the players in the field. And we could see how this area covered by the attacking team being bigger or smaller according to the actions of the other team, of the defending team. Mm-hmm. So these are the types of measures we use. The surface area, the stretch index. The stretching index is a kind of breathing of the team, how it expands and how it reduces the size according to the actions of the game. If they are attacking, they tend to have a higher expansion. When they stretch more, when they are defending, they tend to be more contracted. So this somehow measures how I'm using an expression mentioned by the coach, how the team is breathing, is expanding and contracting, expanding and contracting over the game. That we also use the measure called the centroid, or a kind of center of gravity of the team, the medium point. and how where these points are located over time. So if they tend to be on one side of the court in soccer or on the other side of the court. And there are some relationships that we know from these variables. For example, when the centroid of one team overpasses the centroid of the defending team, that tends to indicate goal scoring opportunities, for example.
Okay.
So we know that there are some expressions of these variables that tells us relevant things about the game.
Okay.
So these were the measures we were using when we see first for characterize the game, characterize the dynamics of the game, and then to see the effects of the constraints, if they were really channeling the behavior of teams that were playing towards the desired situations where we want the players to solve and to be successful in the tasks they were doing.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's really interesting, and I think that's really exciting because that's getting into the area a lot of people are interested in now, sports analytics, right? And I think a key point of what you're doing is you're just not measuring something that can be measured, like GPS tracking. Your variables are based on the theories,
yes,
and they're based on both, and the coach's inputs about what they feel is important. I think that's the key to moving this field forward is we have a million ways to measure things. We just don't know what to measure yet, I think.
And how we feel that. We feel that we are... Nowadays, all the advances in technology, we tend to be driven by data, mm-hmm. not by ideas, not by questions, not by what you want to achieve. But just because you can do it, you can measure, you can have numbers of something, you will going to use that. But I think this can create more anxiety than solutions. Mm-hmm. So you have huge amounts of data that you have no clue what you can do with it. So I prefer to be more information-driven than data-driven in that sense of just measuring things and put sensors everywhere and have measures without questions, you see?
Yeah. No, I have the same. The example I just writing up a study now is doing kinematics of baseball or whatever. We can measure a million different things of a pitcher or batter, but the place I like to start is what variables do we know relate to expertise.
Sure, sure,
and
sure.
Then look at those. That makes my job a lot easier.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't have to look at 50 things. I can pick out four. Yeah.
But I really think the coaches need a little bit of this theoretical guidance. Mm-hmm. I think more than just using our sports science knowledge to develop new technologies, which I think is really the mainstream at the moment, mm-hmm. I think we can be much more useful if you guide a little bit what the coaches can look in order to improve their performance. I think the very high level coaches will not benefit too much from this because I think intuitively they are tuned towards the relevant variables. But for all those that are in this process, and the majority of the coaches are not high level coaches, mm-hmm. I think theoretical guidance can help them a lot about what is the direction of training they are doing, how can they analyze a competition, how can they prepare for the next match, not simply by having numbers and measures or repeating what the other coaches did in similar situations, but having their own way of addressing their ideas about the game, their way of seeing the game, and how that can be guided by what we know about human and team, about individual and team behavior.
Mm-hmm. And I know one of the main theoretical ideas that you've created relates to this is the shared affordance idea,
yes,
right?
Yes.
How athletes decide and how that's different than the traditional approach to teamwork, which is the shared mental model approach.
Yeah.
Can you talk a bit about the differences between those in your mind?
Sure, sure. I'll be very pleased.
Yeah.
Well, I recently read an article that just came out last week from Nancy Cook. And she was really moving into that direction too. She was talking about cognition going beyond the head, not being stuck on the head, but going into other approaches that understand cognition as something that can be expressed in the relationship between the players. I was really pleased to see that because I truly believe in that. I think cognition is not something that is stuck on the head, but it's how you can negotiate your perception and action with the world. So it's something how you relate more with the world and how you just do some tasks that nobody can access to that.
Mm-hmm.
I know that we also can do that and that can be part of cognition, but we can do much more than that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I think a broader understanding of cognition is needed. So, And this is the key, why we tend to develop a different perspective from the shared knowledge perspective. Shared knowledge perspective tend to understand team behavior as something that each player knows about what the other can do and how can I contribute to the other. So it's a kind of individual knowledge that then somehow is shared during competition, and I can anticipate what the other is doing because I previously know what he will going to do and how can I contribute to that. And so, but this puts too much demanding on what we know beforehand about the others and about ourselves. What we thought that would be beneficial in sports, since it's so dynamic and where so many things are happening for the first time or in a very situation-specific way, not something that you can anticipate that on that minute something will happen in that way and the other player will exactly do that, so I can know exactly what to do. So it's things that are much more based on how the situation is changing and not how my knowledge about the situation can fit with what is going on. We thought that shared affordances can do a better job than this shared knowledge perspective. Mm-hmm. And shared affordances is that old training process, of course, can make the players know more the others beforehand. Of course, that is obvious. But can do more than that. Training can perceptually attune players towards situations where each one of them can act according to their own action possibilities and according to how they can contribute to the goal of the team. Mm-hmm. So this means that this is much more immediate than based on what they previously knew that they should do. So the situation can show more immediate information about how to act than just to know if the others are perceiving the same as me, and then I will act according to what is expected from me. Yeah. This is one step behind this shared knowledge. It implies that you are a little bit always delayed according to what's happening in the environment. If what is guiding your behavior is the situation itself and all the players are attuned to that situation, so I think your interaction with the situation can be online, can be in real time and not based on what you previously knew you should do and what the others would do with that.
Yeah.
So this is the key difference is how you can coordinate is based on what the situation shows and not on what you previously knew you should do in that situation and your colleagues should do too. This is the key difference between the shared knowledge and the shared affordances perspectives.
Yeah, and I think another I think you'd point to is it raises one of the things everybody's looking for in team sports is creativity, right?
Yeah.
It creates, in a shared mental model, you can't really go beyond the plays you're taught, right?
Yeah.
And in a sense, too, I think another limitation is it's almost related to the motor program idea. You need some shared piece of knowledge for every possible situation you can face in sport. You need to be able to pull the play or whatever you want to call it, which is really restricting. Yeah.
Yeah, I fully agree. I think if you always know beforehand what you do, it's difficult to improvise whatever it is. It's difficult to create new things. You are always condemned to your own knowledge.
Yeah.
You get stuck into your own knowledge. And I think we see how good players can be innovative and surprising every time they act. Even when for example, we have in Portugal a very good player that is playing in Spain, Cristiano Ronaldo.
Yeah.
We heard about him. Everybody knows his type of drills, how can do the things, but everybody, even the best defenders in the world, fall when he wants to move faster and pass over them. Mm-hmm. So this means that he really has some unique attunement to those situations, to those movements, to those specific constraints that makes his solutions always very sensible to the circumstances. Mm-hmm. And sometimes in a very creative way, we saw how the defender is pushing him towards the line, and at last moment he finds a situation where he can get rid of the defender and goes to the other direction. Mm-hmm. So I think all these new solutions that these players have go beyond the strict repetitions that they did in the past. They are really sensitive to the new situations. So, and I really think this is the basis of being creative. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you can really invent new ways of moving, but the other times you are simply solving your daily tasks, but you are solving it in a unique way, as the situation requires from you.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really good point. And, you know, back to the, if you're, as a team, you're following these very rigid pattern rules about what to do in each situation, it's going to be incredibly easy for your opponent to figure those out, right? Exactly. Especially with all the analytics now and know exactly what you're going to do. Yeah. So it's kind of this battle, I think, Keith called it arms race, right? Of shared opponent. And so
I really think that, and I also think that in some situations that can be useful. Of course, when the ball is stopped, there is a dead ball, and then they have to do a corner or something like that. There are some configurations that you can try, that you can practice beforehand. Of course, that is useful, but that are more the exception than the rule, than what is constant in the game. So I also don't want to say that it's useless to think in that way. I think there is value on that, but we have to know where it is applicable.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that gives you the structure, the basic structure, but then you still need that room to take advantage of something that doesn't fit into this perfect. And fitting into all that, one of the reasons I wanted to talk, you have a book coming out in next year. There's a Rutledge Performance Analysis in Team Sports, right?
Yes.
And you're going to cover all the, is it both kind of the theory and some of these metrics?
Yeah, well, this is more a textbook than a research book.
Okay.
So it means this, we tend to cover, well, we put an emphasis in our way of thinking, but it's not a book just expressing what we think about the game. It's a more broad. We try to cover how the game has been studied in many areas by many researchers in many fields. So it tends to be a more broad, more tutorial way of approaching team games. Tutorial, I mean, more undergraduate and more simple way of simple, but with grounded way of understanding team ball sports. Mm-hmm. So we have an initial section that somehow tried to explain how we can characterize the team game, the differences between volleyball and soccer, for example. How can we understand that from a theoretical point of view? Normally, these differences are a little bit more based on traditions and rules, not really from theoretical principles. And you try to move into how can we theoretically understand these differences? And of course, we will fall into the idea of constraints, because what is changing are the constraints. That goes, and these constraints goes beyond the rules. Normally, the rules are what distinguish sports, but I think there's more than just the rules. There's also how old behavior will be organized with those rules. So that's why we think constraints can be a theoretical principle behind these characteristics of team games. We also then have some ideas of how to measure this, how to measure how it has been measured during all the years with all the notational and observational analysis, all those biomechanical analyses that also are part of these team analytics. Mm-hmm. But also these metrics, these more dynamic metrics that you just asked me before, mm-hmm. like the centroid, the surface area, and these types of metrics to show how these can be useful tools for the coaches to know more about their teams and the teams with whom they are going to play. So some theoretical background about what team games are about, some metrics about it, and then the majority of the chapter is dedicated to specific sports. So to soccer, to rugby, to volleyball, handball, team handball, and basketball, and many other team game sports.
Oh, that sounds great. Do you know when it will be coming out in next year?
Well, we were trying to make it for the first semester, but now it's the first time I'm announcing this. It will not be possible in the first semester, so it will go for the second.
Okay. Well, that sounds really good. That sounds like a really good resource, yeah. I guess the last question I have is, you mentioned the issue of agency, but what are some of the other kind of future challenges you see with, you know, this kind of team sport analysis and some of these other things you're working on?
I think we have more questions than solutions at the moment. Well, I think for me, one hot topic is how can we understand the dynamics of the team with the ideas of the coach? Normally, the coach has some idea about how to approach training and what should be the best strategy and all that. But how the team dynamics influences this, and how this of the coach also influences the team dynamics. I think we know very little about this. We just have some inches, some hints about how these things go together. But I think we know very little about it. So I would like to know a little bit more this relationship between the coach and his ideas and his strategy, and how the dynamics that is emerging is related or not with that, and how the coach's ideas also are changing the dynamics of the team. So I think there's lots to know about the more about this. About the issues of agency, I think it's a fascinating topic. I think it would be easier to see it at an individual level first, because you could know more how you are resisting or delaying or changing a specific invitation. It's more difficult to know, to understand that from a team point of view, but from an individual, and to see more, to understand more this bidirectional link between the environment and the individual. I think there is a lot to know about this. How can we delay? When can we delay this influence of the environment? There are situations where that's impossible when you are falling, for example, but there are others that you can use your own energy to resist to some attractions from the environment. So how can we modulate this? It's just simply because you want, it's because it's desirable for that task. How this dual direction relationship is happening?
Yeah, there's an idea that it's talked about, but I think we need to do a lot more of is, you know, the idea that we move to shape how we get the perceptual information.
Yes, right? Yes, that is a great idea. Yeah.
So we've done a bit in aviation, for example, with, you know, looking at how you actually, you see kind of this inverse effect of what you normally see, where you see experts having lots of variability because it's evident they're exploring, they're trying to get more information. So you're right, the flow the other direction, how the performer acts to get the information when they want and for what they need. Yeah.
I think you put it very rightly. It's really that idea. I think at least powers express it in that way, how you act in order to have better perception. And I think that is really a key issue to address, and because it goes beyond the simple invitation from the environment. Because sometimes sometimes in sports, the adversary team is inviting you to do something that is really bad for you. And so you have to resist to that and to act in a different way to understand more what's going on. So I think there's lots of agency in this process. And the way you point it, I think, is a great idea to explore it. How do you act in order to better perceive?
Yeah. Turning this, you know, you often see in sports, I see in basketball and football and soccer too, where you performer is trying to do something to get the opponents to react so they can get information about what defense they're playing. So they're not trying to achieve their goal. They're just trying to get more information.
Yes.
So great. So
yeah, and to create lines of pass to get the other confused. So let's all have things going on based on they don't have a precise goal. That they will not score goals in that way, but they can know more. How can they move afterwards? And that is really a key issue. Yeah.
Yeah. So I agree. How action shapes information, I think, is an area we need.
Way of putting it,
I need a lot more of them. So thank you for your time today, Dwight. I really appreciate it. I look forward to your book. Keep an eye open.
Thank you very much. So, it's really a pleasure. It's a wonderful podcast that you are doing. And since I know it, I'm following every time I there's a new one. And I'm really pleased to be part of it.
Great. Thank you. Thanks again for the great chat, Duart. I'm really excited to read your performance analysis book and see what is coming from your lab in the future. I think you have some really interesting ideas on how to further develop the concept of affordances. Coming soon on the Perception and Action podcast, the other side of the coin, a look back at schema theory and the contributions of Richard Schmidt. This is Rob Gray from ASU. Cheers for now.